Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related
penalties.
Good
evening, everyone, and welcome to the show.
Advice
this is your
specific
host, Lori
to your
Siebert.
Own situation,
CPA,
we recommend
CFP
that you consult your CPA, CFP,
or attorney. On the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org or on the WDIY app, as well as many streaming services. Today is February 11th, 2026. The markets were flat today with the Dow closing at 50,121, the NASDAQ at 23,066, and the S&P at 6,941. Our topic tonight is understanding your tax return. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Cindy and Bob are in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can speak live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable speaking on air, just give your question to Cindy and they'll write it down and bring it in to me. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. I also want to mention that if you do have tax questions during tax season, no matter what my topic is, as long as I'm the one on air, you're welcome to call in with questions too. Last week, we discussed getting ready for tax season, and I gave you some tips to use to add efficiencies in delivering your, you know, to your tax prepare, your tax papers. Hopefully, it'll save some time. Hopefully, it'll reduce the cost of the tax preparation if it's based on time. And it also helps you avoid missing income reporting, you know, which could lead to, you know, IRS letters or examinations. So it's about kind of being pretty efficient with your pre-work on your tax preparation. We have already started processing tax returns in our office. So if you haven't already started, it would be a good time to get started. We are seeing some benefits to some of the tax changes for 2025 in the extra enhanced senior deduction for people 65 or older within, you know, certain income limitations. So we are going to see a little bit of benefit from that. I personally have not seen any returns with tips or overtime yet, but that could apply to some of you as well, which therefore then leads to potential either lower taxes that you may owe when you thought you would owe more, or potentially refunds, which is why it's always a good idea to get your tax information as soon as possible, get it entered as soon as possible, so you have an idea of what to expect. So that if you do have all your information and you're getting a refund, you get that refund faster. If you get all your information in and you owe, you don't have to pay until April 15th. But you'll know what you're going to owe, and you still have a couple months yet to, you know, save the money to make that payment. Okay, so always a good idea to start early when you can. Now, I understand that some people don't have their tax documents yet, so let me just make a note of that before I start digging into understanding your tax return. Because we often get these questions, you know, why don't we have our tax documents? Isn't everyone supposed to have those, you know, produced by January 31st? Well, that is how it used to be. So January 31st used to be the date that most, financial institutions would have had to have issued 1099s, or your employer would have to issue your W-2, or your pension provider would have to provide your 1099 for your retirement. And typically, we do see the W-2s, the 1099-Rs, the Social Security statements. Those kinds of income get reported quite easily and efficiently and usually by January 31st. So most of you should have already received all those documents. Where we see a little delay is sometimes in the consolidated 1099s, those that you where you would have investments with a brokerage firm, and they report the various income that you have there, interest, dividends, sales, on the consolidated 1099 to make it a little bit more efficient, but then you're having to wait for that a little longer these days. I mentioned this last week because sometimes if you have investments in mutual funds, those mutual funds have to kind of like reconcile their books by the end of the year to know how to allocate gains or that they may have generated within those mutual funds. So that's usually what takes a little longer. Occasionally you may have investments in your brokerage account that might be private real estate. We call those REITs or private credit. And those organizations also quite often are doing a little bit of year-end reconciliation into the new year and may have to make some adjustments to what they reported prior as dividends might now be return of capital. So they're trying to, update those numbers, correct them, based on their, reporting. And then rather than issue a corrected 1099, they just issue it a little bit later. And the IRS has allowed that. So sometimes that's what people are waiting for. But if you don't have that or you don't have mutual funds, then typically what we're seeing, or the private investments, then typically you might already have your consolidated 1099, even if there's none of that reconciliation that's needed. So I would expect that you would have, if you have wages, you'd already have your W-2, you would already have your interest from your bank accounts. Here's another note. Some people sit and wait for their interest from their bank account, and if it's less than $10, they don't have to report it, so you're going to be waiting forever because they're not going to report it. And quite often, you can look at your own bank statement to kind of verify that. Typically, I don't think I've ever seen a year-end bank statement that didn't show year-to-date interest on it. So if you think you're waiting for a 1099 from your bank, just look at your year-end bank statement, and if it's under $10, then you're not going to have a 1099, and that's okay. You don't have to, it's not reported. All right. So cases where you're waiting because you might have mutual funds or private investments that need reconciliation, or perhaps you don't even have that 1099 anymore. I sometimes have seen that too, where people, they hopscotch when they're investing in CDs in banks, meaning they're chasing the best interest rates. And so they might have a 1099 interest statement from a CD that they had at Bank ABC in 2024. And then they cash that out. And in 2025, they went to Bank DEF. And in 2026, they took their money and went to Bank GHI. In those kinds of situations, you also, when you're looking at your prior return to see what kind of income or tax documents you should be collecting for your tax preparer, you'll see Bank ABC and you're like, oh, wait a minute, why don't I have anything from Bank ABC? Well, because maybe it was a CD that you cashed out in 2024 and you don't have one for 2025. So kind of be aware of that. And then it's a good note to make for your preparer that they should not expect that 1099 because you closed out that account. All right. So those are just some kind of extra little tips on the forms. The other thing I'm going to mention before I start talking about getting into understanding the tax return, which I don't remember if I mentioned last week, was just a little precautionary tale. If someone inherited IRAs from a decedent that had died after 2019, so if someone died in 2020, 21, 22, 23, and you inherited it and your non-spouse, you and that decedent was taking required minimum distributions, you too now will have a required minimum distribution. And if you failed to take it in 2021, 2022, 2023, there were some 2024, there were some exceptions. The IRS kind of waived your distribution, that you didn't take a withdrawal, but no more. 2025, you had to take it. And so I'll talk more about that when I come back from a break. I've already used up my time. So if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors. WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
To all of WDIY's generous, sustaining members, setting up an automatic monthly gift on your credit card is the easiest way to support your listening and ensure WDIY remains a strong and thriving public resource. Become a sustaining member of WDIY today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit WDIY.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here in WDIY. Phone number 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy. I'm going to go over this little tax rule really quick. This was from last week. I think I forgot to mention it. It's from my tax department, which does a great job reminding us internally of what we have to pay attention to. So for IRA owners who died after December 31st, 2019, most non-spouse designated beneficiaries are subject to the 10-year rule, meaning the entire inherited IRA must be fully distributed by December 31st of the 10th year following the year of the owner's death. Key distinctions based on the original owner's status at death. If the original IRA owner died on or after their required minimum beginning date, the beneficiary must take annual RMDs each year during the 10-year period calculated using the single life expectancy table based on the beneficiary's age, in addition to totally depleting the account by the end of year 10. If the original IRA owner died before the required beginning date, no annual RMDs are required during the 10-year period, but the beneficiary can withdraw amounts at any time or none as long as the account is fully liquidated by the end of the year 10. The IRS provided transition relief through 2024, meaning no penalties were assessed if they missed the annual RMDs in 21, 22, 23, 24 for beneficiaries subject to that 10-year rule, even when the original owner had reached required beginning date. This relief has now ended, starting with 2025 distributions and ongoing in 2026 and beyond. Failure to take a required annual RMD, when applicable, will trigger an excise tax penalty. Any missed required minimum distribution must be reported on IRS Form 5329 and a waiver request showing reasonable cause and steps taken to remedy can be submitted. And then, you know, further advice was to make sure that you inherit, that you review those inherited IRAs, understand what the required minimum distributions are, and then set it up if you're required to do them. If the deceased owner was beyond required beginning date, make sure that you set it up and do it. And now you don't get a fresh 10 years. It's the 10 years from the year following the year of death. All right. So if we're already like 4 years into this, you only have 6 years left. And if you miss taking it, do it, you know, fix it right away and then ask for abatement from the IRS. Okay. We had a call come in from Robert in Allentown. It's off air. Robert asked, if interest from the bank is less than $10 and the bank does not provide a 1099, you have two accounts from the same bank. One is about less than $7 or $10 in interest, and one is more than $10 in interest. Both are listed on the same statement. Does he need to report the one less than $10? Yes, because that is reported on that 1099. So when the bank issues the 1099, they might show $4 for, you know, account A, and they might show $15 for account B. So then somewhere on that 1099, usually we see total interest of, what did I just say, 10 plus, what did I say, 15 plus 4, $19. So somewhere on that 1099, it probably has the total interest reflected. But the only reason they probably did issue that 1099 is because of the one account that was over. Meaning if you had five accounts that were under $10. I don't know if I've ever seen that. But I would think they would because it's the same bank. So Robert, yeah, I would just report it. And guess what, Robert? If it's just that amount anyway, less than $10, that doesn't even usually move the needle on the taxes, on the tax return. All right. So thank you for calling in with that question, Robert. All right. So the inherited IRAs, I mentioned there's some other little, well, there's a lot of other rules around the IRAs, the inherited IRAs, non-spouse beneficiaries, like if you're less than 10 years and, you know, what's a designated beneficiary. I'm not going to get into all the details of that. Just be aware, if you are someone, your lights should be flashing, caution signals. If you inherited an IRA from someone who passed in 2020 or since, you will have some required minimum distributions from the IRAs. Now, you didn't hear me mention Roth IRAs. Roth IRAs do not have minimum required distributions, which is why if you have an 80-year-old grandparent that you inherited a Roth from and their Roth was, you know, $100,000 and they did not have a required minimum distribution on Roth, and I inherit it, I have 10 years to take that Roth out, but I don't have to take it out because the only time you have to take the money out is if the decedent was in a required minimum distribution phase. There is no required minimum distribution phase for the owner of a Roth IRA. So if you are the beneficiary of a Roth IRA, it's that same 10-year rule, but you don't have to take it out for 10 years. And the concept there is Roths grow income tax-free, and they grow and grow. And so you could let it grow for 10 years, and then after 10 years, you could take it out and have it be tax-free. All right. Now, something you might want to think about, if you have no other money, and you would be eligible to fund a Roth IRA, what you could do is take a distribution from the inherited Roth. This, you know, let's pretend you're going to fund a Roth IRA in 2025 with $8,000. We have until April 15th to do that. And if you're over 50, so let's say you're within the income range to be able to be allowed to fund a Roth, you can take a distribution from the inherited Roth IRA. There's no tax on it. You take that, you put it into your bank account, and then you can fund your Roth IRA. If you have wages, you have to have wages. Okay, so that's something to think about because then you've stopped that 10-year clock on that much of the money, and it's still going to grow tax-free. All right, makes sense? All right, so now let's talk about understanding your tax return. So when I look at page one, let's start with page one. At the very tippy top of the tax return, it's where you're going to tell the IRS certain information, which you may include if, for example, a spouse passed away or the taxpayer passed away. There's boxes there that say deceased, and then there's a box that says, you know, spouse. So those boxes get checked if one or the other deceased. The other thing you have to pay attention to is the address then. Let's pretend it was an uncle. You're the personal representative for the uncle. The uncle has no spouse. Uncle has no children, you know, whatever it might be. You were named executor. You're going to have to put your personal information in the return. Typically, if an accountant is preparing the tax return for you, you have to give them your personal representative information, your name, your address, and that's the address care of that's going to be on the tax return. Also, in the event there's a refund for that decedent, there may be additional information that they're going to have to file. It's a Form 1310 for a refund. If there was no probate, then you can fill out that form and say there was no probate, there was no will, you're the only living relative, whatever it might be, and you'll do a good job, you know, passing out the refund to the people who are supposed to get it. And you attach a death certificate or something. If you're an executor and you were appointed and there's a refund, unless they've changed it for 2025, typically what we have to do is attach a short certificate showing your appointment as the executor, still complete that Form 1310, and now we have to paper file. And then you're going to get a check for the refund amount in that case. So that's why those boxes are important to check if someone's deceased or not, and to fill out the personal representative information. There is other information to put on there. If someone's in the military and they have combat zone, you want to check that box. And when we come back from our next break, I'll kind of dig into the rest of page one, and then we'll see if we can dig into some of the extra schedules that feed into page one taxable income. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
A broad spectrum of financial services. WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy and they'll write it down and bring it in. I'll do my best to answer them. We're talking about understanding your tax return, kind of, you know, digging into some of the little details that you don't really pay attention to. Now, most people probably are not self-preparing anymore, but again, just like the tips last week, if you understand the questions that get asked, if your tax preparer is not giving you a tax organizer to answer these questions or not giving you a checklist, this may be information that would be important for them to know. You want to make sure that when you're putting in your name and address, that you're putting in your legal name that is attached to your Social Security. Social Security number. I can't tell you how many times I've had married couples come in and they say their name is, you know, Bob and Joan Smith. And we find out that Joan never changed her maiden name to her married name. She just thought it just happened naturally. And it's not the case. You have to change the name with Social Security. So your tax return will get bounced if you don't make sure that the names match your Social Security number. Make sure your numbers are entered properly. I don't think it's a good idea to switch the taxpayer and the spouse, you know, from year to year, kind of just stay consistent with it. And then make sure that you are marking your filing status as well, married filing joint or head of household or single, depending on what, or married filing separate, whatever the status may be. There's other questions on there, like, and I don't even recall seeing this, but did you live in the U.S. for more than half the year? More recent questions in the past few years, digital assets, you might miss it on the tax return. And basically, you have to answer if at any time during 2025, did you receive or sell or basically have transactions in digital assets? That includes non-fungible tokens. If you did, then you check that box, and then there's various places you can report it. I'll talk about that in a minute. Your dependents. Important to note the names, Social Security numbers, and relationship if they lived with you for more than half the year and if it was in the U.S. as well as and if those dependents qualify for the child tax credit or if it's a credit for other dependents, meaning if you have a child who is 17, they are a you can get a credit for other dependents. It's like $500. But if you have a child who is under age 17, then you can qualify for a larger child tax credit. Additionally, if the dependents are full-time students and or disabled, there's a box to check for that now. Some additional information regarding filing status of married filing separate and head of household relating to living apart the last 6 months of 2025. I think the reason they have the question on there for that is in certain circumstances, you may be able to file single if your state law also recognizes this. So if you lived apart for the last 6 months of the year, you're officially legally separated and your state law recognizes that, then you may be able to file single. There's certain circumstances. Personally, I've never seen it. Pennsylvania does not recognize that. So watch out for those filing statuses, particularly if you're over 65 and let's say you just think there's a particular reason you'd want to file married filing separate, that could really, really hurt you for Medicare premiums. So if you think you're going to save income tax, you better check it out, because you may save income tax, you know, in very rare circumstances. I've rarely seen it save, but it would also really hurt you for Medicare premiums. IRMA premiums are tough on married filing separate people. Robert called from Allentown again. Robert is asking about Roth IRA. Contribute to IRA, you need wages, yes. Can it be spouse wages? Yes. If filing joint, what about pension wages? Pension wages are not wages. Wages are earned income that you have a job. So you have to have earned income, W-2 earned income federal wages. And as long as your income is within the proper range, you can do spousal IRAs, Roth IRAs as well. So for married filing joint, the threshold for 2025 is if it's under $236,000 and your spouse has wages, you could fund a Roth IRA. If your income's under $236,000, you both could. That's a separate Roth IRA from any kind of 401k option. And then there's a phase out between 236 and 246, and then no Roth contribution over 246. What you could do then, if you have no other IRAs, would be something called a backdoor Roth, where if you have no other IRAs, it kind of works. You do a non-deductible IRA contribution, and then you can later convert it to a Roth. It's a little complicated. It would take more time for me to explain. I want to make sure that I just mention it, though. Backdoor Roth could possibly work for people if they are above those income thresholds. But let's say, Robert, in your situation, maybe you're retired and your spouse is working a job and they make $30,000. As long as your income is below those thresholds, if their federal wages are $30,000, you could each put $8,000 into the Roth, you know, from your bank account. So yeah, Roth IRAs, love them. Income tax, they grow income tax free. And once you establish an individual Roth, you can't take out the earnings the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, but you can always take out your original contribution. So just tons of flexibility there. So I hope that answered your question, Robert, but pensions do not count as wages. So that does not count. It has to be earned income. All right. So let's continue talking about the understanding your tax return. Most of the income on your tax return is reported on tax forms, as I mentioned at the beginning of the hour. Those tax forms reported to the IRS are from providers of your income. So whether it's wages, it's your employer, interest income, it's your bank. Dividends, it's your broker. IRAs, it's the custodian of the IRA. Pension, it's the pension administrator. Annuities, it's the insurance company that sold you the annuity. Social Security, government. Capital gains, reported on consolidated 1099s. So this is the income that you want to make sure you report accurately. And when I kind of thought that through, I thought, wait, I don't want to mislead anybody. All of your income needs to be reported accurately, but these are the numbers that the IRS is tying into. So what I mean by that when I say file accurately, it means if there's $5,000, you know, reported in interest income and you mistype and you put $500, well, they're going to jump on that faster than whatever the phrase is. So you want to make sure that you're reporting the numbers accurately. And, you know, you give those tax documents to your tax preparer and you're counting on your tax preparer to report them accurately as well. But it's still your job to look at it. It's still your job to, you know, review your tax return because you are signing under penalties of perjury. Now, you know, there are times when that has happened. It may get missed and you can file an amended return and say, you know, oops, sorry, you know, we inadvertently omitted something or oops, we inadvertently did a typo and correct it. And if you're ahead of the IRS, then quite often they don't even charge you any kind of penalties. But if you miss it and then they have to write a letter to you, they're probably going to put a penalty for underpayment. If you reported $500 instead of $5,000 and you owe an extra, you know, $1,000 of tax, they're going to charge you penalties and interest for underpayment. But if you're proactive and you catch it first, that also helps. So watch out for those tax forms. Those get all reported on page one, and we're going to talk more about that when I come back from our next break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors offering a broad spectrum of financial services, including estate planning, tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents, on the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 669-8680-9000.
Welcome back. And if you have questions, as Robert has tonight, Robert, thank you for the questions. I love questions. Any regular listener knows that's my favorite part of the show, questions. You can call at 610-758-8810, and you can talk live with me. Or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy, as Robert did, and it works just as well. So I do appreciate the questions because, you know, chances are somebody else has those same questions. And it's always fun for me because sometimes I can learn from those as well. When we're talking about understanding the tax return, why we want to understand the tax return is because we want to make sure that we're, you know, providing all the information that's required, that we're checking all the boxes that need to be checked. And in doing so, that makes sure that we're, you know, what do I want to say, mitigating the risk of an examination letter, audit letter, whatever it might be, a letter from the IRS. And just as a note, you will never be contacted by the IRS via phone or email first. They will always send you a letter first, okay? And then let your accountant know. I also try to tell my clients, do not worry if the IRS contacts you with a letter. Do not worry until I tell you to worry, because the IRS may or may not have, you know, all the information. So don't worry until I tell you to worry, because sometimes it just needs a little bit extra review. That's where we find out, oops, we might have missed something, or oops, you know, they didn't get your estimated tax payment. Then we have to have you go check, did the check clear? Did it get canceled? There have been some circumstances, and this is I'm going off topic here just for a second. It's still tax topic, but not your federal tax return. And that is, I've had situations where certain taxpayers will send in their estimated tax payment for Pennsylvania, for example, and put their Social Security number on the memo for the check. Now, if you put the voucher in the envelope with your check, you would hope and think that Pennsylvania would look at the voucher and credit it to the, you know, the taxpayer number on the voucher. I don't know if this was done electronically. It may have been done electronically. And when you went in, the spouse was doing the payment and put their Social Security number on the estimated tax payments. Well, Pennsylvania, despite you filing a married filing joint Pennsylvania tax return, they treat you like two different taxpayers. How many of you knew that? That they're treating you like two different taxpayers, but you're able to file a joint return. And if you are someone who, let's say a husband has, you know, interest at ABC Bank and wife has interest at her favorite XYZ Bank, you will see if your accountant inputs that information, taxpayer, this 1099, spouse, this tax 1099, you will see on your Pennsylvania return that there are two different interest schedules for that reporting, because it splits it up. Where you really, really notice it is when the one spouse might have their own brokerage account and they sell some stock at a huge loss, you know, $10,000, and the other spouse sells their stock in their individual brokerage account at a $10,000 gain. Well, what you're going to see is two different Schedule Ds on Pennsylvania. And guess what? They don't offset each other. Because remember, we're separate reporting entities. Now, if we had a joint account where, you know, a joint account where we had a $10,000 loss on one stock and a $10,000 gain on another stock for Pennsylvania, that does offset because you own it jointly. All right. So you want to make sure that you're entering your status as well on those tax documents. But that's how estimated tax payments can get messed up too on if you put the wrong Social Security number, because Pennsylvania is always looking at the primary, the first tax, what we call the taxpayer's Social Security number. All right. So going down kind of page one, I told you there's wages, and wages are that's earned income. We talked about earned income earlier. Earned income gets reported on a W-2. There are some W-2s that actually don't get reported as wages. And we would see that reported on another schedule, Schedule 1. And why would we see W-2 wages reported on Schedule 1 and not as wages, as earned income? Because some what we're going to call wages is actually deferred wages. It's deferred compensation. And while we were working, we have may have been a participant in a deferred compensation plan where the employer let us defer paying tax on that money. They hold it. We don't take it. We have no constructive receipt. So the IRS says, okay, then you don't have to pay taxes on that because you didn't take constructive receipt of it. And let's pretend I put $10,000 in it for like 5 years. That's $50,000. And then at some point I take that deferred comp. And that deferred comp would get paid out to me depending on the election I used to take the deferred comp. Could be over 5 years, 10 years, maybe, you know, forever. And that deferred comp is reported like in a non-qualified plan. And it looks like it comes through on a W-2, but it looks a little bit different. And there's a box 11, I believe, on that W-2 that shows it's a non-qualified plan. That doesn't get reported on the same wage line as regular W-2 income. That gets reported on a different, on Schedule 1 for other income. All right, so we really want to make sure we're understanding what is getting reported on the tax return. So we have a line for wages. We have a line for interest. We have a line for tax-exempt interest. That tax-exempt interest, we need to make sure we're understanding that too, and that your tax preparer is understanding it. So, for example, if I have tax-exempt interest of $1,000 and taxable interest of $5,000. That's a total of $6,000 of interest, but $1,000 of it's tax-exempt. Why do we have tax-exempt interest? We have tax-exempt interest when we invest in municipal bonds. So it's to encourage us to kind of support our community, our state, our school districts, whoever may be issuing bonds for, you know, revenue generation to build, you know, something new. And that is tax exempt for federal. It may not be tax exempt for state. It depends on what muni bond you bought. If you live in Pennsylvania and you bought a Michigan Muni, that's not going to be tax exempt for Pennsylvania. So what I would expect to see for Pennsylvania would be $6,000 of interest. All right. So we have to understand, what is that tax exempt interest on that page one? What is our taxable interest on page one? So now I'm going to mix this story up a little bit more. Let's pretend the $5,000 of interest was actually U.S. Treasury interest. I cashed in some savings bonds or a T-bill or a T-note, a Treasury note or a Treasury bill. And that's U.S. Treasury interest. For federal, that is taxable. $5,000 is taxable. My $1,000 of tax exempt is not taxable. Now I'm going to go over to my Pennsylvania tax return. I got my Michigan Muni interest of $1,000 and I have my U.S. Treasury interest of $5,000. Guess what? That's not taxable for Pennsylvania. So the number I'm showing on my Pennsylvania tax return is $1,000. This is why you have to understand your tax return, how they work, how they coordinate with your state. Make sure your accountant knows. You know, I don't know who's preparing your tax return. This is why I have to talk about these things. It could be a CPA. It could be an enrolled agent. It could be someone who's been trained very well. And it could be someone who's not trained very well. It could be your next door neighbor. It could be your kid. I don't know who's preparing your tax return. These are the things you want to know and understand on your tax return. We're trying to take the fear out of tax returns. So understanding wages, interest, tax-exempt interest, dividends. When we look at dividends, we have ordinary dividends and we have qualified dividends. This also throws people off. If I look at a brokerage statement and I see $10,000 of ordinary dividends and I see $7,000 of qualified dividends, it doesn't mean I have $17,000 of dividends. It means I have $10,000 of dividends. And of that $10,000, $7,000 is qualified, which means it qualifies for a lower tax rate. If you're self-preparing and you're doing calculations on, you know, a piece of paper, this is a tough one to figure out. I recommend doing software or hiring someone to do your tax return. So $10,000 or, you know, total dividends, of which $7,000 qualifies for a lower tax rate, you have to do a worksheet, a capital gains tax worksheet, capital gains qualified dividend worksheet. Now, let me throw in an extra little tidbit here. So we on that 1099, we see ordinary dividends of 10, qualified dividends of 7, and we see capital gain distributions of 3. Where do those $3,000 capital gain distributions go? It all depends. If you didn't sell anything in 2025, then you can put that capital gain distribution right on page one of the return, right on page one. And there's a box you can check that says, hey, I had capital gain distributions, but I had no sales. I do not have to file Schedule D, because that's where we normally would have to report sales of investments. But because a capital gain distribution is one of those things those mutual fund companies have to, you know, reconcile their books on, and they're going to let you know, of the dividends we paid you this year, Lori, you're going to have capital gain distributions of $3,000, because I didn't sell anything, but the mutual fund company sold all year long. So buy and sell, buy and sell, buy and sell. And at the end of the year, they figured that of all their buying and selling, they had gains that they allocated to me of $3,000. If I had no other sales, I could put that on page one of the return, check the box, don't have to do Schedule D. But if I had other sales, it flows to Schedule D. And if I had losses on my other sales, that will help offset that capital gain distribution. So now let's say in my story, I sold $10,000 of stock. I had a $10,000 loss on some other stock sale, and I had $3,000 capital gain distribution from my mutual fund. I actually have a $7,000 loss on Schedule D, of which I can use $3,000 on page one of my tax return. So I can use a $3,000 loss of my total capital losses on page one of the tax return, and the rest carries over indefinitely. We can use it in the future against other gains or against other capital gain distributions until it's used up, or against ordinary income up to $3,000. All right, so this is where you're following your tax documents. You're following it, flows through the tax return in these various ways. And guess what happens on Pennsylvania? That $3,000 capital gain distribution for Pennsylvania, they don't count it as a capital gain distribution. They count it as a dividend. So now my dividends, I never gave a number for my dividends. Let's say my dividends were $5,000. Now over on Pennsylvania, I would have expected to see $5,000 of dividends, but now I had this capital gain distribution that on federal got offset with other capital losses, and I had a loss on my federal, but on Pennsylvania, now I'm adding $3,000 of capital gain distributions. Now I have $8,000 of dividends on Pennsylvania. So these numbers don't always tie out. And what's really tricky is maybe those $5,000 of dividends on my federal return were actually generated from a mutual fund that was invested in U.S. Treasuries. Well, then I have to look at my little pamphlet that fund company sent me to tell me how much of my fund that I earned those $5,000 of dividends was actually invested in U.S. Treasuries. And if my $5,000 actually was in it could have been a U.S. Treasury money market fund, and let's pretend it was invested in U.S. Treasuries, 90%. It was called the blank, blank U.S. Treasury money market fund or federal government money market account. It might not always be 100%. Let's say it's 90%. Well, of my $5,000, if that's what it was, that's ordinary dividend. It's not a qualified dividend. It's not qualifying for that better tax rate. But for Pennsylvania purposes, I have to know that to enter into my software, because guess what? That won't be taxable for Pennsylvania, right? Understanding your tax return, you can understand a lot of tax savings. We're at a break. If you have questions, phone number 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. Anyone else get excited about
WDIY
this stuff?
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors.
I'm sitting here all by myself. I hope my listeners are enjoying it.
Really, you can make it fun. And
if you're someone who gets very stressed out and anxious about your taxes, I promise you it does not have to be that way. Just having a little bit of understanding or, engaging a tax preparer to prepare your return for you to help you through it, it's okay. It can be fun. But you want to also be an advocate for yourself, just like, when you have a patient in the hospital, you always need an advocate. You need an advocate for yourself for your tax return, too. And that could be yourself when you're hiring someone to prepare the return for you. Make sure you're reviewing everything, particularly for those people who are 70 and a half or older who are eligible to make qualified charitable distributions from their IRAs. Make sure that your accountant catches that or you let them know what it is. And how this works is if you took $10,000 out of your IRA and put it into your bank account and then gave $5,000 to charity, that does not count. That doesn't count as a qualified charitable distribution. It actually has to come directly out of the IRA to that charity. Your 1099 currently, I think someone told me they're starting to come through. I'm not sure about that. They're going to put in a new box on the 1099Rs to indicate a qualified charitable distribution. But I'm not sure that the custodians would actually always know how to make sure that's done or done properly. There's different ways you can make qualified charitable distributions. One is asking the custodian to write the check directly. And then there's situations where the client can have a checkbook for their IRA and write the checks to the charity directly out of their IRA. There, it's a little bit different nuance there. When the custodian writes the check, it's deemed to be made. When you're writing the check, you have to make sure the check clears before the end of the year. But the custodian's not going to know that you're doing qualified charitable distributions if you are the one writing the checks. So you do have to kind of track that and make sure you keep track of it, and then make sure that your tax preparer knows to code the taxable portion of your IRA appropriately to reflect the qualified charitable distribution as a reduction in the taxable amount. So if the IRA distribution was $10,000 and I gave $3,000 to my church, then the taxable portion should only be $7,000. In future years, I think they're leaning toward trying to find a way to track that so that it could be reported properly. But currently, what's coming through is taxable amount, a gross amount 10, taxable amount 10, and the tax preparer has to go in and override the qualified charitable distribution portion of that IRA, put $3,000, and then on page one of the return, you're going to see a box checked that says QCD, or you'll see the letters QCD. That's how they indicate why the IRA portion is less than the IRA taxable portion is less than the gross amount. All right. You also might see a taxable portion of a Roth distribution. You heard me say earlier that Roths, I love, they're tax-free. It's after-tax money. You can always take out your original contributions. You heard me say you can always take out your original contributions. But if you have not waited the 5 years and or age 59 and a half and you take out more than the original contribution, then those earnings could end up being income taxable unless you have an exception to that distribution. It could also be subject to a 10% penalty. So potential Roth distributions could be the earnings if they're coming out before 5 years or age 59 and a half, the earnings could be income taxable and subject to a 10% penalty unless an exception applies. You can track your cost basis for those Roth contributions on Form 8606. Page one, pensions and annuities. Pensions, there's a gross amount and sometimes there's a taxable amount. Pensions, usually it's the same amount. Occasionally it's not. Occasionally there's a little bit less, like if an employee rolled over some, I don't know, after-tax contributions into their pension, then it may not all be taxable. We typically actually see that more on annuities if someone's made an investment in a non-qualified annuity, meaning outside of an IRA. If I invested $50,000 and my annuity grows to $60,000, okay, $10,000 of appreciation, that's not capital gains, that's ordinary income. So if my $50,000 investment grows to $60,000 and I take out $5,000, the earnings these days, the earnings come out first. So if I take $5,000 out, I'm going to pay tax on $5,000. If I take out the full $60,000, so I invested 50, grew to 60, I take out the full 60, 10,000 is going to be subject to income tax. All right. So you want to make sure you understand the cost basis, the investment in those annuities. And if you continue to exchange those annuities into a new annuity and exchange into a new annuity, those are called 1035 exchanges. You're deferring the tax on the growth on those annuities when you move it into another one. But it's still the original basis. It's not the, you know, when you buy, if you take my 60,000 annuity and go into another one, my basis doesn't change to 60. It's still 50. All right. Be aware of that. Let's see what else. Social Security. Social Security, we have a gross amount that's reported, and then we have a taxable amount. The taxable amount that gets reported all depends on how much other income you have on your tax return. It's a you know, terrible worksheet to have to go through. Thank God that we have software that figures it all out for us. But it all depends on your other income on your tax return. And sometimes I think people get surprised when they, you know, always think they have low income, and so they take more money out of their portfolio or take gains, and they don't realize that impacts the taxation of their Social Security. Circular calculation, and just watch for that. So gross amount and taxable amount are not the same. And then there's a line item for other income, additional income, and that comes from that Schedule 1, which I'm going to have to go through really, really quickly because I always take longer than I think. So part one of additional income, that includes like taxable refunds. We don't even see those almost anymore because hardly anybody itemizes anymore. But starting in 2025, people may itemize again because they lifted the cap on the SALT deduction, the state and local and real estate tax deduction, from 10 to 40, depending on your income, because there is a phase out. So if we see more people itemizing now in 2025, then you could end up with state, you know, refunds, or that in the past, if you had a state refund because you got a state deduction, it could be taxable income in 2026 for you. So you want to watch out for that. Alimony's on there. Well, a lot of people nowadays, they don't have a deduction for alimony, and you don't get to have to report alimony on new divorces. So there is a place to put the date of the original divorce or separation agreement. People, you know, I think who were divorced years ago getting alimony, that would be where you would report that. Business income, Schedule C, a whole separate schedule for Schedule C, but the bottom line profit or loss comes through over here on additional income. Same thing with Schedule E for rental properties and or, you know, certain other kinds of income. Schedule F for farm income, unemployment compensation, and then there's other kinds of income that gets reported there as well. Jury duty, prizes and awards, activity not engaged in for profit. So, for example, I just had a client who said they were paid to participate like in a medical study and received $2,000. That's where we would report that. It's activity not engaged in for profit. If you're not engaged in for profit, they just kind of gave you this money, then we don't have to do a Schedule C and we don't have to pay self-employment tax. Self-employment tax is basically Social Security and Medicare tax, but that's how we avoid it, by putting it here on this schedule. And it comes through on a 1099 MIS, not a 1099 NEC. NEC is non-employee compensation, and that's typically Schedule C income. Other kinds of income, remember I mentioned about a W-2, and I said if it's not wages, how can we have a W-2 that's not wages? And I mentioned it could be a non-qualified plan. That does get reported on a W-2. Also, you might see on that same W-2 for the non-qualified plans, the deferred comp, it may be taxable for Fed, and it might be partially taxable for state. Back in the day, Pennsylvania did tax this deferred comp up front. So when you got it later, it wasn't taxable. But then back in, oh golly, I can't even remember what year it was. Maybe 2005? I don't remember. When they changed and they started following federal. So there were people who were deferring their compensation pre-2005 where that money will not be taxable for Pennsylvania. But anything deferred after that will be taxable from Pennsylvania. And there was like a phase out, a couple year phase out thing too. So you want to kind of watch out for that and look for those numbers. Quite often the non-qualified money may not be taxable for Pennsylvania for a lot of the tax returns I've seen. It all just depends. All right. Let's see what else. Pension annuity income, digital assets. So remember I mentioned about digital assets, and you have to check a box if you had any, you know, transactions for digital assets. And I said it could get reported in any number of places. So you want to make sure you understand why you're getting these digital assets. You might just be doing it as an investment, and that's what I suspect a lot of people might be doing. If you bought it years ago and you've not sold or bought any, you can check the box, but I mean, it's only if you sold some, I think. So if you sold some digital assets that you held for investments, that gets reported on the Form 8949, which then flows through to Schedule D, just like you would report any other like investment, gain or loss. If you received digital assets as payment for work that you've done, and that is self-employment income, that would be reported on a Schedule C. And then there could be other kinds of circumstances where you may have received some digital coins that might just be, you know, regular ordinary income, that it wasn't something you sold, you weren't in a business for profit, and someone just, you know, maybe it was a prize. I don't know if they pay, you know, digital coins in a prize, but then that would be on this Schedule 1 as additional income. Okay, let me see what I have not covered yet. I think, oh, I was going to talk about tax tips and overtime have their own schedule now as well. And that is a Schedule 1A, I believe. So Schedule 1A. And also on that same Schedule 1, there's also deductions. So we would have deductions for whatever it might be. I can't grab it right now. I've got 2 minutes left, but because I do want to mention about the no tax on tips and no tax on overtime. Be aware, I've mentioned this before. Employers may or may not have reported that. So they, you know, you may have to rely on your own records for some of this, but keep in mind for the no tax on overtime, it's only on the overtime portion, not the regular wage portion. So if you make $10 an hour, you got paid 15, it's only the five that is, that has no tax on that portion of the overtime. And if someone got paid double time, I don't know if anybody gets that anymore, but if you got double time, so you make $10, you got paid 20, it's only five. It's only half time. It's only the time and a half, the half time on the pay, not your regular pay and not double. So just be aware of that. And then the tips, not all tips are not subject to that, so just be aware of that. And then quickly, the last thing I wanted to mention, where's my refund? Remember, you can go on the IRS's website, irs.gov, and usually that's the first page you land on. It clicks, you know, where's my refund, and you just have to enter your the refund amount, your Social Security number, and the tax year usually, and it'll tell you what the status is of your refund. Maybe, you know, if it's been processed or if there's no information available, or if they mailed it out, you know, like a week ago, that helps you kind of know where the status of your refund is. So I hope that was helpful. Next week, I'm going to be out, and I have Matt Petrozelli, CEO of Valley National Financial Advisors, guest hosting for me. And he's going to give you an introduction to him with his key lessons learned on investing on his journey from sales to CEO. So that will be Matt Petrozelli next week. I thank him for doing that. Thank you, Bob and Cindy. Thank you for callers, listeners. Thank you, Bridger. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices.